This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The last time it took the House more than one round of voting to choose its new speaker, 1923, which means this week, Americans are witnessing something not seen in a century, the inability for a House majority to quickly pick a new speaker and get on with the business of governing. By the way, for my fellow On Point history nerds out there, there have only been 14 multiple ballot elections for the speakership in U.S. history. 13 of them happened before the Civil War. But it is a kind of internecine battle currently playing out within the Republican Party. Nebraska Congressman Don Bacon has taken to calling the radical intransigence in his party the Taliban 19. And on Wednesday, one of those radicals, Colorado Representative Lauren Boebert, had this reply from the House floor.
Let's stop with the campaign smears and tactics to get people to turn against us, even having my favorite president call us and tell us we need to knock this off. I think it actually needs to be reversed. The president needs to tell Kevin McCarthy that, sir, you do not have the votes and it's time to withdraw. With that, I yield. Thank you.
Well, actually, no thank you, because you're not yielding. That's basically the paraphrase of what Texas Congressman Dan Crenshaw said about the extreme faction of his party. Crenshaw spoke to reporters inside the Capitol yesterday.
This handful of members is very clearly looking for notoriety over principle. That's what it is. And anyone who suggests differently is in some kind of make-believe fantasy reality. It's not true. If you're a narcissist and you believe that your opinion is so much more important than everyone else's, then you'll keep going. And you'll threaten to tear down the team for the benefit of the Democrats just because of your own sense of self-importance. That's exactly what's happening here. We will not vote for anyone else but McCarthy. These people think they're stubborn, we're more stubborn. They think they're not going to get the committees. Obviously they won't, but it's going to be so much worse than that. They are enemies now.
This is more than theater. It is more than a momentary attention grab, I'd say. It is a glimpse into the House Majority Party's ability to govern, or inability to govern. So what will the GOP do in the House in this new Congress? That's what we're going to talk about today, and joining us to do that is Sarah Longwell. She's publisher of the journal The Bulwark and host of the Focus Group podcast. She's also director of the Republican Accountability Project, and she's been conducting focus groups with Republican voters for quite some time now to see what they want from their party. Sarah Longwell, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, I actually want to start, first of all, with some basic whys, because I think there are a lot of Americans who are just kind of repulsed by Congress in general and may not have been paying as close attention as the wall-to-wall cable TV coverage might indicate. So why are, this extreme faction of the GOP in the House making this stand right now?
Well, you know, this is one of those things that sometimes I talk about the forces that Donald Trump unleashed on the party. And this is a good example of it, where what this caucus wants is not. I listened to what Dan Crenshaw was saying, where he says they want notoriety over principle and that they're narcissists. Well, that sounds like somebody else. That sounds a lot like Donald Trump. And so what these guys have learned as a lesson is that just sowing chaos in the face of governance is actually something that there is an appetite for among Republican-based voters. And I hear this all the time, and it's embedded sort of deeply in who the Republican Party is. And there's a healthy manifestation of this where people talk about limited government and, local control and finding ways to keep the government from, becoming an overbearing force in people's life. That's a healthy way of discussing it. In their version, it is just chaos, shutting things down, seeing that government can't function. They're not actually, and this is why Kevin McCarthy has such a tough problem on his hands, because they don't have a set of clear goals. They don't have things that they want to achieve. They're arguing over things like rules, because it's actually about their power. And the power that they want is to be able to ensure that governance can't happen. They want to be able to shut things down. You know, one of the things that's taking place is that Kevin McCarthy, he is so desperate to become the speaker that he keeps making more and more concessions. And with every concession, he actually weakens his ultimate ability. If he ultimately prevails, he weakens his ability to do any kind of governing. I mean, things like it sounds like the deal they've reached potentially means that any one member of Congress could have a motion to vacate, could sort of challenge him and have him, and they're asking for major committee assignments, right? This is about them understanding that by simply saying no, by sowing chaos, that they can get things that they want, that they can get notoriety, that they can have a role in this right-wing media ecosystem, they can become more famous, and that there is a base of voters who will applaud them for it. They're all fundraising off of this. And so, you know, it's funny. I've been watching some people kind of frame it as though there's a sort of moderate faction and an extreme faction in these 20, but that's not quite right. Because, you know, what Kevin McCarthy has already said is that what he'll do is launch a lot of investigations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not like they're talking about a lot of good governance, but this small faction, it's just pure chaos wanting to shut things down.
Yeah. So let me ask you, there's a lot in what you said that I want to dig into in detail over the course of this hour. But let me just begin with this pure chaos. First and foremost, I'll be honest, I have not been able to keep up intensely with every little thing that this extreme faction is saying. But so is that like really what they're actually saying out loud, that their whole point in causing this major tumult right now is just the chaos? Or are they saying they're standing on some kind of principle?
Well, they're saying they're standing on anybody but Kevin. Right. So this is what you have to understand is that there is a just never Kevin faction. And so what they want is somebody else. They want to win. They want a scalp because that's a demonstration of their own power. Right. So they're sort of sowing chaos in service to their own power. And they're saying so. And it's funny, in this group of 20, there's actually a spectrum of people. There are people like Chip Roy. Now, Chip Roy is just a hardline conservative who really does want to wrest a bunch of these concessions around rules, making, you know, and sort of disempowering leadership. But then you've got people like Lauren Boebert and Matt Gaetz, and they are pure chaos agents, pure interested in their own power and their own notoriety, their own celebrity. And so they're basically saying that their goal is just not Kevin. Like that's all they're not saying, hey, we're here to sow chaos. They're here to say I think they do think that on some level the principle is never compromise with the Democrats, right? Like I think their objection to Kevin, why they're never Kevin, is that they see him as the kind of sort of smooth operator, establishment type who will sell out conservative principles to compromise with Democrats. And this is a fundamental shift that's happened over time where Republicans don't see Democrats as political opponents. They see them as sort of existential enemies.
Yeah. Well, but here are some of the so-called conservative principles that this faction is espousing, right? I'm thinking about Scott Perry, right? And he voted against a House resolution condemning QAnon. So he voted against condemning QAnon. He's endorsed the great replacement theory about, you know, white Americans being replaced by others. We now know from the January 6th investigation about his text to Mark Meadows during the attack on Congress. And I even think he spread around YouTube videos suggesting that votes had been manipulated by Italian satellites. So there's nothing that's like traditionally conservative about you know, what this faction actually believes in.
That's a great point. And it's actually been frustrating. I mean, the word conservative has sort of lost all meaning at this point. And I've watched it be drained of its meaning over a long period of time, but especially throughout the Trump administration. And that's why the framing, again, of these folks as, well, this is the hard right, or these are the real conservatives. That's not really true. They are, in many cases, and look, I don't want to just hurl names at people, but these are crazy people. And I think in many cases, and Perry is a good example. Lauren Boebert is a good example. These are people who are not sort of ideologically committed to something about the way that they think government should behave. These are people who learned, I think, from Trump that simply by trying to break the system, by saying burn it all down, by engaging in conspiracy theories, that it buys you a lot of attention from a slice of the Republican electorate and by certain media outlets that have sort of, you know, built up on the right that service this faction of the party. And so, yeah, that there is not an ideological commitment for many of them. It's just about burning it all down.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, though, they're right, because look at what's happening now. Everybody is focused on them. We're focusing on them and their impact on the GOP for this hour. So regardless of what happens with the speakership vote, in a sense, has this extremist faction of the House GOP already proven that it has power in this Congress?
Absolutely. Again, if Kevin McCarthy does, and I think, you know, it's possible, but the chances continue to diminish. But if he does become speaker, he will be incredibly weak and he will be at their mercy. There is a part of me that wonders what goes on in Kevin McCarthy's head where he wants the job at this point, because you can see what this job is for him. He will be at this group's mercy for his entire tenure as speaker, and they will be like a sort of Damocles hanging over his head. Anytime he steps out of their line, what they want, they will try to hold him accountable.
Well, we are talking with Sarah Longwell today. She's publisher of the Bulwark Journal and host of the Focus Group podcast. And we're trying to understand what we're seeing this week in the GOP majority in the House and what this means for how Republicans can or will govern in the new Congress. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today, Sarah Longwell joins us. She's publisher of The Bulwark and host of the Focus Group podcast and director of the Republican Accountability Project. And she joins us today to help us understand what's happening in the Republican majority-controlled House right now and what it means for the GOP's ability to govern in the new Congress. Now, Sarah, I just want to play a couple of clips here of things that some of the extremist faction of the Republican Party in the House have been saying in recent days. Here's Republican Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, one who has voted against Kevin McCarthy for the speakership. And he has thrown his weight in at least one of the votes behind Jim Jordan of Ohio, saying Jordan would make a better speaker than McCarthy.
If you watch the speech that Jim Jordan gave, quite honestly, most Republicans sat there and said, oh my goodness, why isn't this guy running for speaker? And while I know Jim would be reluctant, I remind everybody, George Washington was reluctant too when his country called.
By the way, that reference to Jim Jordan and George Washington in the same breath was also repeated by Lauren Boebert as well on Fox News. So it seems to be a talking point coming out of this caucus. But here's Florida. Here's a Florida Congressman, Matt Gaetz, also talking about Jim Jordan.
Maybe the right person for the job of Speaker of the House isn't someone who wants it so bad. Maybe Jim Jordan is the right person for Speaker of the House because he is not beholden to the lobbyists and special interests who have corrupted this place and corrupted this nation under the leadership of both Republicans and Democrats.
That's Matt Gaetz of Florida. Now, Sarah, of course, as you know well, Jim Jordan isn't the only person that's been put up against McCarthy here. This group has also voted for Arizona's Andy Biggs, for David Joyce, and, of course, Jim Jordan, amongst a couple of others. What are these other votes telling you about who they're throwing their support behind?
Well, these are really just anybody but Kevin votes. And I think that the strategy here, to the extent there is one, which I would be loath to be assured that there is a strategy here, but I think it is to wear down, to sort of hold that group of 20 together and to try and grow it, to show Kevin that it cannot be him. And ultimately, come forward with a consensus candidate. And I think the name that people sort of throw out the most is somebody like Steve Scalise, who's a McCarthy ally. But, you know, right now, Kevin McCarthy's sort of argument is he's still got the most votes. Like, yes, there's these 20 holdouts, but nobody else can get as many as him. But that's not quite true. There are other consensus people if McCarthy were to actually step aside. I mean, but really what we're in right now is just a good old fashioned game of chicken. And one of the things that's going to happen is either you start to see an erosion of the 20, and Kevin McCarthy gets some momentum, or you start to see that 20 number grow. And the goal is for Kevin to be forced into seeing that he cannot win. The biggest problem for Kevin McCarthy, though, is simply one of math, which is he can really only lose 4 votes. And right now, there are 5 who say never Kevin under any circumstances. And so they're at a genuine impasse. And so at some point, this sort of holdout faction is going to have to sort of put up an alternative that is one that sort of everybody can agree to.
Who would that be?
Well, Steve Scalise is I think, the most likely name. And so to get that deal done, it would have to be something where Kevin sort of Congressman McCarthy agrees to step aside and sort of puts his hands on Scalise and says, I endorse this, you know, this is my ally. And he understands that it's never going to happen for him. And I think the faction of 20, one of the things they are saying is somebody but Kevin, you know, anybody but Kevin. They want some other name. And I think, but it is odd, you know, they've been putting up Donald's, a young, I think, one-term congressman. They voted for him now a couple of times. And that is not somebody who is ever going to build consensus in the House. But somebody like Steve Scalise, who's well-respected, who's already in leadership, that could be a consensus pick.
Mm. You know, I'm thinking back to what I asked you about what the Boberts and the Gates of Congress actually believe, because, you know, the QAnon stuff. And, you know, we played that tape of Matt Gaetz, and I should have said right afterwards that, you know, this is the same Matt Gaetz who's under investigation for, you know, possibly violating federal sex trafficking rules here. So let's turn now, Sarah, if we could, to all the focus groups that you've been doing with Republican voters. Amongst those people you've talked to, do they, you know, how are they responding to seeing these folks, you know, this group of 20s supposedly standing up for, you know, put it in quotes, principles?
Sure. Well, so I haven't done any focus groups since in the last couple of days. So I don't know how people are reacting to this specifically, but I have done hundreds of groups now over the last few years. And one of the things that I can tell you is that to the extent that Republican voters know who Kevin McCarthy is, especially people who are big Trump voters, they don't like Kevin McCarthy. In fact, they talk about him in extremely unflattering terms. I remember there was a guy who just kept calling him garbage over and over again. And they call him a rhino. They think he is somebody who is kind of represents everything that they – and this is an important sort of point. You know, when you talk about an internecine fight in the Republican Party, there's a psychology here of there's a big part of the base that actually likes to – be against the establishment Republicans. They refer to them as the Uniparty, and they dislike Mitch McConnell, and they dislike Kevin McCarthy. And what they liked about Donald Trump is that Donald Trump was going to come in and break these guys. And that's sort of the great irony, actually, in everything that's happening now, which is that there's kind of formed a MAGA establishment that includes Kevin McCarthy, where Trump has endorsed McCarthy. But this other holdout group, even though Trump the man doesn't have control over them, isn't able to kind of get them on board, he did unleash certain forces that they've internalized and that they now embody, which is, how do you sow chaos? How do you burn it all down? How do you use sort of a plurality, or how do you use the fact that there's an appetite among voters for this chaos to sort of build a brand around? And so that's the thing I see among the voters, is that there's an appetite among a big part of it. It's not like the Republican voters or the Trump voters especially sit around being like, you know, what I really want to see is good governance. Or, you know, that's just not how they talk. What they want is, they want a fighter. They want somebody who goes after the establishment. They talk about rhinos a lot. That's something that's really been burnt into the lexicon, this idea that there is a part of the party that is in cahoots with the Democrats, and that you have to break that up. You have to defeat that. And so Kevin McCarthy represents that to voters. And so my guess is that the reason that Matt Gaetz feels very empowered in this moment is that they know there is a decent chunk of the Republican base that is on board with what they're doing.
You know, maybe you just answered it, but I was going to ask you, when these voters tell you that McCarthy et al. Are rhinos, that implies that they have some sort of definition in their mind of what they believe an actual Republican is, right? So how would they define that beyond, or is there a definition in the minds of these voters beyond the burn it all down?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's interesting. When I talk to voters, and I ask them often, you know, what did you like about Donald Trump? And they'll say, well, I really liked his policies. And I'll say, okay, which policies? And they'll say, well, the America First policies. And it gets at something going on with Republican voters, where it's become so much about culture, so much about identity, so much about tribe, and so much less about policy achievements or goals. And I would say that to the extent that there's policy, they tend to be very broad in things like, well, I want, you know, I don't like the socialism of the government, and therefore, you know, I want somebody who's going to be a fighter against Joe Biden and these big spending Democrats. And so, yeah, the idea of what a Republican is now, it's this, they call themselves America First Republicans. And it's almost distinct now from Trump the man. And it really is about Trump the phenomenon of people sort of identifying with a MAGA tribe.
You know what's so fascinating to me, though, because I suppose this is one of the unfortunate inevitabilities of having conversations like this, is I find myself, you know, tending to use broad generalities like Republican voters, right? Because I want to be very clear here. For example, in places like Lauren Boebert's district, in the 2022 election, she only won by 546 votes. Right, out of more than 300,000 votes cast. So this like small fraction of a percent was her margin of victory. Granted, she got half of the votes here. But I guess what I'm getting to is, like, how widespread is the beliefs and desires of the base that we're talking about amongst broader Republican voters?
Well, now you're at the fundamental problem for Republicans today in terms of electoral power. Because one of the things about Boebert's district is that is actually a heavily Republican district. Mm-hmm. But the reason that she came so close to losing is because there are a lot of Republicans for whom Lauren Boebert is much too extreme. And this is the problem. So the base has become increasingly radicalized. And Kevin McCarthy and all of the people who are now suffering the repercussions of this, they all contributed to that radicalization. But that radicalized part of the base, the kind of burn it all down, I'm not interested in policy, this is just about America First tribalism, that base is quite large. There's a reason that Donald Trump was able to, in most cases, get the primary candidates he wanted during the Republican primaries, because base voters, you know, they want these election denying sort of extremists. But then when it comes to swing voters, to moderate Republicans, to the, you know, college educated suburban voters that you need to build to sort of win general elections, they are Republicans are increasingly alienating those kinds of voters. And I talk to swing voters all the time, and it's so interesting. So many of them going into 2022, they were frustrated with Joe Biden. They wanted to vote for Republicans, but they did not want to vote for the Republicans that they had up for election in their states. They didn't want to vote for Carrie Lake or Blake Masters. They didn't want to vote for Doug Mastriano. They didn't want to vote for Dr. Oz. And so, you know, Republicans, what you are witnessing right now, what is playing out in this House fight, is a manifestation of a bigger, there's a growing gap between what the base voters want and what moderate swing voters want, who are available to the Republican Party, but not this version, not this Trumpy extremist version of the Republican Party. And that's the fundamental tension that they're experiencing right now.
Okay. Well, we did talk to some folks who believe that the tension will eventually resolve. And one of those folks is GOP strategist Kim Alfano. And she told us that she thinks in the end, those radical holdouts will ultimately fall in line with the rest of the Republican caucus in Congress.
There's only so much you can get done with a Democratic Senate and a Democrat president. But I think that we will be bringing the votes that people want brought. How we get them through to become laws is going to be a little bit trickier. If Kevin McCarthy isn't elected and it's someone else, it is going to be chaos for a while. People will just be like, oh, it's back to Washington as usual. So even the right, far right, if they want to be respected as a party at all, need to kind of fall in line.
That's Kim Alfano. Sarah Longwell, do you feel as sanguine as she does?
No, not at all. First of all, these 20 have their whole point is that they're not going to fall in line. That's the message that they're sending. We will not be, you know, threatened into falling in line. Leadership won't have this power. And also, you know, I think that when she said sort of they won't be able to get things done what the people want to get done. I find this notion to be interesting. It goes back to the point I was making earlier about this should not be framed as the moderates versus the extremists or the people interested in governing versus those not interested in governing. It should be the framing should be the chaos agents, the burn it all down folks versus people who want to spend their time investigating, you know, Hunter Biden and impeaching Mayorkas. It is just the degrees of the circus are just different. And I think while I would certainly argue that there are still responsible people as part of the Republican caucus, and that I think that it's certainly better for Kevin McCarthy to be the speaker than, say, Jim Jordan, I don't think we should I think we have to understand just how far, not to the right exactly, but how far in the performative anti-governance direction this Republican Party has moved.
It just makes me wonder then. I mean, what? So this means that there will be what? No governance coming out of the out of this new Congress?
Well, that's not exactly. But to take one of the biggest fights that is upcoming, which is the debt ceiling.
Yeah.
So there is going to be, and in 2011, the government, people will remember this, the government was shut down for a period of time over the debt ceiling fight. And actually, that's a big part of what these sort of chaos agents want. They want concessions on that. They do not want to raise the debt ceiling. And of course, with a Democratic Senate, like, that's not going to fly. You know, they're going to have to compromise. And this is the other thing, look, at the center of all of this is because Republicans so dramatically underperformed in 2022, their expectations, Kevin McCarthy simply has a very, very narrow majority. And that means that he's going to have to compromise with Democrats. And what this far right faction wants, that's the grave sin, right, is the compromise, is the idea that you would work with Democrats or compromise on things in order to keep the government functioning, because they're not particularly interested in the government functioning. And so, you know, I think right now they're either trying to make sure that it is not Kevin McCarthy or that they tie his hands so much that things can be gummed up very quickly, or the government can be shut down very quickly. to keep him from, you know, working with the Democrats to compromise and things. So I think you're just going to see an incredibly dysfunctional House. I mean, what we're seeing right now is a preview of all of these. I mean, if they have to pass omnibus legislation, you know, what you want is lots of debate. What you do want people to, there's nothing wrong with having heated debates and with going back and forth and with arguing and fighting and ultimately reaching a consensus. That requires compromise. Like Kevin McCarthy, he should compromise with Democrats. Everybody, you know, there should be, and there's been actually a decently functioning sort of shadow Congress over the last few years that has gotten a lot of things done. You know, they passed bipartisan infrastructure. But these hardliners, that's what they don't want. They do not want these compromises. And that's what they're trying to shut down with all of this.
Well, we are talking today about what this internecine battle, as I've been calling it, within the Republican Party in the House portends for governance in the new Congress. And Sarah Longwell is walking us through all that. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Sarah Longwell joins us today. She's publisher of The Bulwark and host of the Focus Group podcast and director of the Republican Accountability Project. And we're talking about what the current battle between House Republicans about the speakership of the House says about the GOP's desire or willingness to govern in this new Congress. And Sarah, I want to spend a couple minutes talking with you about really being honest about how different policy-wise, if we can even put it that way, Kevin McCarthy and the Republicans he represents in the House, how different it is from, you know, this radical faction we've been talking about. So let me play a couple of bits of tape from this week. This is just from last night when Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, he held a press conference and he was calling on his Republican colleagues to find a solution to this leadership crisis. Gallagher is a former Marine, and he said that the disarray within the GOP right now has U.S. national security on hold.
Right now, Don Bacon and I were supposed to be meeting with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs in the skiff here to talk about matters in the Indo-Pacific. But I'm informed by House Security that technically I don't have a clearance. I'm a member of the Intel Committee. I'm on the Armed Services Committee. And I can't meet in the skiff to conduct essential business. My point is, we have work to do that we can't do right now.
That's Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin referring to, of course, the secure facilities in which members of Congress can meet in the building. Now, here's the voice of a former Republican congressman. This is Rodney Davis of Ohio, former again, who spoke with CNN's Jake Tapper earlier this week, saying that the current disarray is preventing the GOP from accomplishing what he thinks voters put them in office to do.
If Kevin McCarthy stays in this race and we go to ballot after ballot after ballot, there's going to be a lot of pressure on them because their voters sent them here to hold Hunter Biden and Joe Biden accountable. They're not going to have Jim Jordan as the chair of the Judiciary Committee until we get a Speaker of the House.
You think that voters sent the Republican majority to the House of Representatives to hold Hunter Biden accountable?
In their districts, their very Republican districts, absolutely.
Sarah Longwell, respond to that.
Well, I guess he's not wrong to some degree that there is base voters who are kind of obsessed with the Hunter Biden laptop laptop story who are, you know, looking around for some like turnabout is fair play from the investigations of the Trump years. But frankly, the fact that they were focusing on Hunter Biden, the fact that they've been the Republicans have been so focused on those things versus, I mean, what the swing voters actually care about is the economy. They cared about inflation. They cared about supply chains. They cared about kitchen table issues. And so I have heard actually a number of the more, let's call them the more responsible wing of the party, Dan Crenshaw, for example, saying that, you know, what the voters really sent us here to do was to stop Joe Biden's hiring of IRS agents. That tends to not be certainly what I hear from especially swing voters. And so now, but to the point, though, that the other gentleman was making about like that's why voters sent them there. There is true. Again, the base voters, that's what they want. They want performative. They want their team to win. They want to go after Joe Biden. But the fact is that the reason that Republicans underperformed and didn't do as well with swing voters, and ultimately the reason for the narrow majority, is that what a majority of voters want and what these swing voters want are responsible people who don't say elections were stolen, who are not chaos agents, and who are going to focus on the things that matter to them, like healthcare, the economy, you know, recovering from COVID, getting people back to work. That is what people care about. And Republicans aren't talking about that nearly as much as they're talking about Hunter Biden. Right. And it's a broad appeal to the base.
Right. And it's not just those extremist Republicans who are not talking about that. I mean, I would argue that, like you said, maybe the quote unquote more responsible Republicans aren't really talking about it all that much either, because you had mentioned the debt ceiling, right? And I remember from last fall, I think it was just as early as last fall, when Kevin McCarthy himself had signaled that the Republicans in a Republican-led House, they would hold the debt limit up as basically a bargaining chip to advocating for policy changes they want. I mean, he had said, I'm looking at a quote here, said, "You can't just continue down the path to keep spending and adding to the debt. We're not just going to keep lifting your credit card limit," right? So that's one thing. And then the other thing that he had actually said that he wanted to do upon becoming speaker was rescind the appropriations that were made just last year to hire 87,000 new IRS personnel. So how different really is what the McCarthy-esque kind of Republicans in the House want from the Lauren Boberts and Scott Perrys of the world?
Yeah, well, this is my point about I don't like the framing of moderates versus extremists. I think we've seen the entire party move to a much more extreme, much less focusing on governance direction. That being said, I think part of it, so take the debt ceiling. There is I think I've been a Republican my entire career up until the Trump years in which, and I saw the conservatism sort of lose all meaning. But I think that it's fair to say, hey, we can't just spend ourselves forever. And to have that, to say, look, and I want to negotiate ways in which we're going to think about cutting our spending or curbing our spending, that there's a responsible way to do that. There's a healthy way to do that. That is different from being sort of happy. Like, the goal should be to not shut down the government. Mm-hmm. But there is a faction that will be more than happy to shut down the government, to see it shut down for a period of time. In fact, Matt Gaetz tweeted about this. Every day that we do not have a Congress, which we do not right now, we have elects, people are not. Every day that we don't have a Congress, he says, this is great because we're not funding Ukraine. And I think that's a difference. The Ukraine funding is a big difference, where you've got a bunch of members of Congress who would like to not provide any funding to Ukraine. And the more responsible wing, the less extreme wing, though it's still filled with people who denied the election and all kinds of other problems, but that less extreme wing, they do want to fund Ukraine. And so like those are the kinds of fights you're going to see.
You know, Sarah, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I think most Americans feel a combination of embarrassment and disgust at what's happening in Congress right now. What do you think is preventing that sort of core group of base voters from feeling that same embarrassment and disgust?
Because I think they believe that, again, it goes back to the psychology of not believing that government should be small, but hating government in general. And if you hate government and you don't want to see it function, and you believe that the dysfunction is part of the point, and look, there's been part of the right wing media ecosystem has been really pushing this point for a long time now, many, many years, which is, you know, this is the swamp. You got to drain it. No money. It shouldn't function. There is the reason that Matt Gaetz has a sense of the wind at his back is because he knows that there is a chunk of voters to whom this makes him a hero, not by advancing any particular principle, but by simply standing against the idea of government being able to operate. That's it.
Hmm. Well, you talked about that right-wing media ecosphere. Let's listen to how the current disarray amongst the Republican House caucus is playing out in that right-wing media. So here is Fox News' Sean Hannity with Colorado Representative Lauren Boebert just last night. It got a little testy.
Sean, I understand the frustration, I promise you, but
I'm not frustrated.
He does
you didn't
not
answer
have the
my
votes.
Question.
And we are hearing from many people who are still voting with Kevin McCarthy,
you're
who
not
are
answering
very
my
supportive
question.
Of what we're doing, and they're cheering us on. So there are more for us than are against us, and they are waiting for Kevin to cave.
Okay.
You know, the American people are certainly frustrated by...
I'm frustrated by you not answering a direct question. You said earlier today that President Trump needs to tell Kevin McCarthy you don't have the votes.
We need to come up with a consensus candidate to elect a Speaker of the House.
You don't have the votes, and it's time to withdraw.
That's Sean Hannity. Well, on the same network, his compatriot Tucker Carlson was telling the McCarthy camp also last night about how they should be negotiating with the Never Kevin faction of the party.
Well, you've got reservations about Kevin McCarthy? You don't want to be ruled by a man who wears a Ukrainian flag lapel pin and lives with Frank Luntz? No problem. We get it. Let us try to convince you. In a normal race, that's what you would do. But that is not what Kevin McCarthy's team is doing. Instead, like the left, they purport to oppose. They're using threats and fear to force people to support the candidate. Anyone who opposes Kevin McCarthy, one of his surrogates explained today, is, quote, an enemy, a, quote, terrorist. That's their message.
So, Sarah, how do you decipher the Hannity-Carlson divide?
There's a lot going on here, but one thing is that, look, Tucker Carlson has become the embodiment of the burn it all down faction. He is their Pied Piper in many regards. But it's been interesting because Murdoch, who owns Fox News and some of the other publications, seems to be squarely on Kevin McCarthy's side and has really been pushing. A lot of this has to, in some ways, comes back to Donald Trump and wanting to get beyond Donald Trump and put the Republican Party back into this more responsible place. And that's the thing about Kevin McCarthy is that, you know, he has tried to be all things to all people. You know, he brought Marjorie Taylor Greene in close to him as a way that he thought he was going to be able to pacify sort of that hard right faction. And, you know, the sort of establishment Wall Street Journal Republican Murdoch media, right? They want Kevin McCarthy, who they think, look, he's going to pacify kind of the base, but ultimately he's going to be a responsible Republican, try to keep government small, keep taxes low, and win, right? I think one of the things that you hear, I think a big frustration from the sort of the establishment or the old guard Republican side is they're very tired of losing and they would like to have Republican governance. And so they're looking for people who can win because they recognize that this burn it all down faction is alienating swing voters from them. And yet they also know that a big like Tucker Carlson has a specific kind of viewership of people who love the burn it all down stuff, who love the idea that there's a uniparty, right? I hear this from the voters in the focus groups a lot, this idea of a uniparty. And a uniparty is basically that Republicans and Democrats work together to keep down sort of just average people, that they're all working together as some sort of a cabal. And that's why there is always going to be purchase. There is always going to be opportunity to run against the Republican establishment. That's what Donald Trump did. And that's what all of these people like Lauren Boebert and Matt Gaetz. That's what they're mimicking now. They know they can, if running against McCarthy, running against the establishment, that has purchase with a lot of voters.
Yeah, but those same folks that you're talking about, just they helped create that monster, and they're living the "be careful what you wish for" moment. Because you might just get it. I mean, you talk about the GOP being trapped in a kind of triangle of doom right now. Can you explain that?
Sure. So the Republican triangle of doom is the toxic and symbiotic relationship between the right-wing infotainment media, Republican voters, and Republican legislators. So because the right, over the last 30 years, has really built up its own media ecosystem, that has created this radicalization process. And I'll give you an example. So right after the 2020 election, there wasn't, you know, not lots of people didn't think that the 2020 election was stolen in the immediate aftermath. Donald Trump was saying that it was stolen. And then the right-wing media ecosystem picked up this idea that it was stolen. And voters started to believe. So like base voters also wanted to, like, this idea it was stolen. They couldn't possibly lose. It had to have been stolen. And they believed the president. And then ultimately, then they started saying to, you know, legislators saw where their voters were going, saw where the right-wing media ecosystem was going. And so they felt the need to say, yeah, boy, those results are suspicious. And I think that the election was stolen. And that creates another loop where people who didn't before think it was stolen now say, well, boy, my congressman is saying that the election was stolen, or my senator's saying the election was stolen. And before you know it, it goes from sort of the Newsmax OANN world into Fox News world. And over time, then you end up with 70% of the Republican Party believing that an election was stolen. And so the Republican triangle of doom is really about a radicalization process. And that is where it's been interesting watching Fox News, because I would say in the Trump years, they were basically all part of the same sort of the same team. And now they're breaking into factions between, again, the burn it all down side and the side that wants power and knows. And I guess both sides want power, but the one that wants governing power, like one side just wants power by sort of being able to tie things up. The other side wants power by actually being able to govern and do things. And so Sean Hannity's siding with that side of power. Tucker's siding with the burn it all down side of power. Yeah. And both have purchase within the current Republican Party. That's the fight. That's the battle.
But this is a sort of a self-supporting loop, though, that you're talking about.
It is.
The triangle of doom. We've just got a minute left here, Sarah. How would that triangle be broken then?
Well, I'm not sure you can break it. I think maybe you can shrink it. Mm. And look, my solution has long been, there's sort of two things that needs to happen. One, this reversion of the Republican Party needs to suffer sustained electoral defeats. And that's been happening, where people are just consistently rejecting this Trumpier MAGA version of the Republican Party. Swing voters don't want it. But then the other thing is, at some point, you're going to need leadership, and it's going to take leadership to solve this problem. And I would like to see a new generation emerge that kind of is an answer to this Trump moment, where people say, we're putting that behind us and we are going to get back to ideas of limited government, fiscal responsibility, but we're going to be responsible. You can trust us. We're not just chaos agents.
Well, Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark and host of the Focus Group podcast and director of the Republican Accountability Project, it is always great to talk with you, Sarah. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.